Hello, and welcome to this walking tour, highlighting some of the untamed women in Ogden's history. My name is Katie Nelson. I'm a historian and co-host of What's Her Name podcast that tells the stories of the lost women of history, and I'm also a proud Ogdenite. And I'm delighted to share these stories of our bold and brave Ogden women with you. This tour starts in front of St. Joseph's Catholic Church on 24th Street and Adams Avenue. So if you're not there already, press pause and get yourself there. It's a cool building, right? I'm going to tell you about it. But first, I want to start our tour in an unexpected place. Head east toward the mountains, up the sidewalk. Take your time, no rush. I want to take you past this parking lot on your left and up to that vacant lot beyond. When you get to that empty lot, stop there for a bit. Not much to look at, I know, and a weird place to start off our tour, but this vacant lot was home to a lady that I really admire, Jane Richards. So as you approach that blank, empty lot, build up in your mind the picture of a small Victorian house, maybe like that house at 521 across the street. And out front on the porch sits a small woman, quiet, unassuming in her Victorian black satin dress, high collar, stiff corset, hair pulled tight in a bun. But this lady isn't what she seems. Jane Snyder Richards represented the 25,000 women of Utah at the first ever assembly of the National Council of Women in Washington, D.C. in 1891. This National Council was formed by Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Maybe you've heard of them, the great Votes for Women champions. But guess what? Jane Richards was there too, almost from the start. She said, Mormon women have a head start on equality. Utah women already had an all-female-run hospital, a female-published newspaper, and $100,000 in real estate. Jane Richards was asked to give a speech at that historic assembly in 1891. And she wasn't one for the spotlight or public speaking, but she took a deep breath and did it anyway, saying only a few sentences before handing the podium on to someone else. She said, I have the honor to represent Utah, and I feel thankful for the opportunity today to be here on our platform. And it seems to me, by the sentiment of all that have spoken, that it is love and goodwill and peace and joy to be extended to all. That is what I believe in. That is what the 25,000 women that I come to represent today are working for. In just a few sentences, she formed a credo. The goals, the dream of Ogden women for a century to come. That love and goodwill and peace and joy be extended to all. So I wanted to tell you about Jane Richards starting at this empty lot, because she's one of the first Ogden women we can know much about at all, and she paved the way for Ogden's women to come. But here is the site of her house, empty and forgotten. And nobody's ever heard of Jane Richards. And I think that's deeply symbolic. So often, women's contributions to history have been downplayed, ignored, or even erased. Usually it's not maliciously done, it's just the result of assumptions society made at the time about who's important and who gets credit for stuff. So during this tour, I want to bring back some of these forgotten women, even if there's not much left of their worlds to look at. Because they each took different steps in the pursuit of equality for women. What they have in common is that untamed Ogden spirit. Even in the face of prejudice and ignorance, these women changed the shape of this city and of America. So, we don't have Jane Richards' house. But look, there's the driveway leading to nowhere. And that lamppost on the west side of the driveway, well, that was a life-changing innovation, electricity, that arrived in her day. Take a look at the street. Back then, it was just dirt. One man who spoke at her funeral remembered a stormy spring day on the street in the 1860s. The wind howled, the soaked streets turned to deep sludge. Everyone huddled inside, but he spotted a figure struggling in the rain. It was Jane Richards, out in the downpour, holding up her skirts as she slogged through the mud. What on earth are you doing out in this weather? He asked her. She replied, there are still poor folks somewhere in need. She was a generous person, always there to help. She was small and quiet. She hated the spotlight, but she had a fierce side too, a real spark, untamed. Go ahead and start heading back toward St. Joseph's Church now, on these easy, paved sidewalks. At that historic assembly in Washington, D.C. in 1891, you know the one with Susan B. Anthony, the women there committed to working toward universal goals. Jane Richards would go on to dedicate her life to these goals. I want to list them for you here, because for the rest of the tour, we're going to meet other historical women who took up the baton where Jane Richards left off and carried it a bit farther and a bit farther still to achieve equality. 1. All institutions of learning be freely open to women. 2. Job training be equally provided to women. 3. Universal suffrage, the right to vote. 4. Women enter every field of work across society and get equal pay. 5. Moral standards be identical for women and men. By now you should be approaching the front of the church. It's impressive. It was built in 1899. See that plaque on the west corner of the street? The red and yellow sandstone is a Victorian neo-Gothic style, which means the Victorians like to make things look medieval. The tower is 132 feet high, and the stained glass is gorgeous. You really get a better view on the inside when the sun is shining at an angle. If you're here on a weekend, it might be open. Head inside if you want. Otherwise, just wander around the outside. The organ inside is pretty spectacular, and it was installed by cooperation between Catholics, Mormons, and Protestants working together to bring music to this space. And did it ever have music? In 1915, Beatrice Dobbs came to work as the choirmaster here. For 53 years, she brought music to the people of Ogden, and not just through the choir. She brought world-class concert and theater series to Ogden and managed them. She helped form the Eccles Community Art Center, which is still thriving a couple blocks away. She was a member of the Utah State Art Council and the Symphony Guild, and that's just the music. She was also up to her eyeballs in national service organizations like the Children's Aid Society, Community Chest, and Beta Sigma Phi. Beta Sigma Phi even named her National Woman of the Year in 1947. And let's not forget that she was also the ladies' champion at the Ogden Golf Club. In 1957, Beatrice Dobbs was honored by the Pope himself. She was awarded the Cross of Honor, the highest medal that can be awarded to the laity by the Pope, given for distinguished service. So, our musical lives here in Ogden are rooted in the foundation laid by Beatrice Dobbs. Concert series and symphonies, music lessons, art centers. She spent her life doing all she could to open these doors for us. Okay, if you're still inside the church, pause the tour here until you're outside again. Outside, turn toward that intersection on Adams Avenue, the one with a traffic light. Move on down toward that corner, and then head west across Adams Avenue when you get the green light. This intersection right here was the site of a pretty exciting moment in Ogden history. May 19th, 1881. It was on that day that the newly formed Ogden Electric Light Company staged a spectacular lighting ceremony. They were, for the first time, going to light the city with electric incandescent light. They mounted a globe on top of a steel grid, and you can see how this location would be perfect for such a spectacular show. The light would shine down on the whole city from this hill. Surely Jane Richards would have been out here watching with fascination. Many people were skeptical that electricity was the future. It was dangerous and mysterious, they thought. Oil lamps and candle flames were much safer. I'd love to have been there in the crowd for this grand reveal, though, because it failed. The city did not light up, and skeptics went home satisfied. Okay, if you're on the other side of Adams Avenue at this point, just head on down the hill and check it out. You can see all the way down 24th Street. It's a great view of Ogden from here. Continue on all the way down to the corner at Washington Boulevard. Back in the late 1800s, we would have been passing, on the right, the county courthouse and jail. It was a three-story building with a metal clock tower. Think of all the human drama that has unfolded here for 150 years. Judges heard who knows how many thousands of cases. A lot of human stories ended here. A lot of stories began. And in that same era as Jane Richards and that failed electric lighting experiment, another boundary-smashing Ogden woman practiced law here. Marianna Coulter was the only female member of her law class in the 1880s, and that was not an easy thing to be. But she believed that the betterment of humanity happened in tiny, persistent steps, and she wanted to be a part of it. She was the president of the Utah Federated Women's Club and a member of the Order of Women Legislators, the European Literati, Book Lovers Society, and the French Academy of History. She was also the national vice president of the Women's Lawyers Association, and she was a suffragette. She spent a fair amount of time traveling to attend marches, meetings, parades, and women's suffrage votes across America, and all of this while wearing a corset. Dressed in delicate white dresses, like other suffragettes at the time, she was a powerhouse disguised as a sweet, pretty lady. Marianna Coulter dedicated her life to what she called the persistently finer evolution of the human spirit. She was elected to the state legislature in 1902, where she sponsored legislation for social causes like education and child labor. And I do think the human spirit is finer for us now because of work like hers. By now you may be approaching the Weber Center on the corner. When you're there, go ahead and find a seat in the plaza here while I tell you about another woman who fought some legal battles across Weber County. Just as Marianna Coulter was fading from this life, another brave woman arrived in Ogden, not yet aware that she was destined to meet the next legal struggle head-on. Her name was Ruby Jewel Price, and she came to Ogden around 1942, intending to train to be a fighter pilot. Her brother's plane had been lost in World War II, and she was going to go and find him. But here's where that goal that women receive equal job training hit a brick wall. Female fighter pilot? Nope. But it wasn't just that she was a woman. She was Black, and this was the 1940s. In her words, to be a woman of color in Utah was to be cursed. But this lady took that curse and turned it into power. She was prevented from becoming a fighter pilot, so she became a force for racial equality at Hill Air Force Base, advocating for equal facilities for all people. Then, in 1943, an Ogden policeman shot and killed a young Black man under suspicious circumstances. The Black community came together to formally organize a local chapter of the NAACP to help fight their legal battles. And Ruby Jewel Price became their first president. And while she was at it, she became the first Black school teacher in Utah. Over many decades, Ruby Price became a legend, smashing boundaries all over this state. She became lovingly known as Grandma Ruby. What did she not do? Grandma Ruby was the type of person who sported heart-shaped sunglasses and feathered caps and big purple fedoras. Her appearance reflected her spark, her untamable spirit that she radiated. She was a Girl Scout leader for 60 years. She was Teacher of the Year, Republican Chairperson, Medical Board Chairman, Handicapped Unlimited Founder. She was given the National Guard Minuteman Award, the Huntsman Excellence in Education Award, the Outstanding Citizen Award. She was National Volunteer of the Year and First Black Mother of the Year. And those are just the highlights. She died just a couple years ago at age 102, and she kept that spark to the end. One of her more famous quotes is, "I was born free and independent, and I intend to die free and independent." Now we're going to head north on Washington Boulevard, so that would be turning right from where we came. Go ahead and walk all the way to the end of this block. As you walk, look across the street. See that plaza with the Junction sign? This block was once the site of a couple of legendary department stores. On the corner was ZCMI, Zion's Cooperative Mercantile Institution, a chain of department stores run by Mormons for Mormons to band together for more economic power. And farther up the block, Woolworths. They were both grand structures. Back then, the whole idea that you could walk in and around a shop and choose items for yourself was novel. See, before that, the only way to buy something you needed was to step into a general store. Picture like the small shops of the Wild West. And you tell the person at the counter what you need. They would go back into their storeroom and get it for you. But now, with department stores, you could have an experience. You could browse all there was to buy in the world and imagine yourself owning it. And crucially for women, you could buy clothes off the rack rather than making your own. You could buy beauty products, hats, shoes, already made, and female shop attendants helped you choose it. For young women, this was a totally new employment opportunity. It offered class and prestige. It offered money and independence. The young women who came to work here were taking a bold step toward the future. But the job wasn't just a job, it was an identity, it was a lifestyle. Because in Victorian department stores, female employees were held to all kinds of moral standards that never applied to men. Rules about their appearance, where they lived, where they went, and how late they stayed out at night. And when you married, that was that. No more job. This was the double standard women like Jane Richards wanted to change. By now, you should be approaching the corner of Washington and 23rd Street. Turn left and cross Washington westward when you get the green light. While you're waiting at the light, look back down Washington where we came from. From the 1970s to the 90s, there was a glass sky bridge that connected the two sides of the street so shoppers could cross without stepping across the street. In that same era, lots of Ogden women loved to go for lunch or afternoon tea at the famous Tiffin Rooms, which were on the east side of the street. That plot of land over there on the corner was, in the earliest days before 1860, a barn belonging to the West family on the outskirts. The local folks held barn dances there. I wonder if they could have imagined the future bustling city we have now. When you're across the street, keep heading west on the sidewalk, and then carefully cross at some point until you're standing in the small plaza in front of the Solomon Center. Are you in front of the Solomon Center? Then you're standing on the site of the home of another untamed Ogden woman. Look around. Can you see a historical marker on a pole? We've put that up to honor Sarah Anderson, who lived right here in 1895. Sarah was deeply involved in the suffrage movement. 1895 has been called the most important election in Utah history because, among other things, it was the election where we voted for statehood. Sarah Anderson wanted to vote, and she didn't think being female should stop her. She left her house here, walked 3 blocks south to the second precinct, and declared she wanted to register to vote. Charles Tyree, the clerk, refused on grounds she was a woman, so she took him to court. The local judge ruled that Sarah Anderson and all women did indeed have the right to vote. But the case was appealed to the Territorial Supreme Court in Salt Lake City, and that case she lost. As soon as Utah became a state in 1895, Sarah Anderson and other Utah women leaders drafted a petition to the state government, reminding them that their first order of business should be to grant women the right to vote. They did, and the next year, women voters helped to elect Sarah Anderson to the state House of Representatives. She was one of the first. She was sidelined in the House, of course, blocked from making any waves. But hers was a huge first step for women's voices in government. And all this while she was a widowed mother of 5. She died here suddenly in 1900 after a short illness. I wish more people knew about Sarah Anderson and the boundaries she pushed. It took guts and persistence to do what she did, all by herself. We're in the heart of the junction here, and we're going to continue west now on the sidewalk. If you're here at the right time, there's always good people watching inside the Solomon Center, with indoor skydiving and indoor surfing going on behind those windows. The things we have in the 21st century. Incredible. On your right, in 1891, Anna Wright ran the Lincoln Hotel, a boarding house that advertised itself as a first-class, quiet family hotel that boasted all modern improvements. Anna Wright appears in a lot of newspaper articles that even let people know if she was sick. She was a really popular figure in the community. All this area you're walking through used to be old Victorian shops and workshops. In the 1980s, the city bulldozed all of it to make way for a shopping mall. 20 years later, the mall came down too, and now we've got this. When you get to Grant Avenue, you don't need to cross it. Just take a left across 23rd Street here. We're heading south now. And you'll notice the difference between the left and the right sides of the street. Here on your left, a parking garage stretches on forever. Again, a product of the bulldozing that happened twice in the past few decades. But some buildings on the right-hand side survived, like that Proudfit building. Do you see it? It was built in 1921, designed by Leslie Hodgson. Sports as exercise, sports for your health, were just beginning to be a thing during the 1910s and 1920s. And today you could say we're building this city in a similar spirit. You've probably noticed the wide bike lanes and sidewalks. This is the pilot street for a bike and pedestrian-friendly design of downtown Ogden that we hope is going to be extended all around. Pretty great. And one day, these new trees, they will be tall and elegant. And people 100 years in the future will think of us as the people long past. It reminds me of that proverb that a society grows great when people plant trees under whose shade they do not expect to sit. The building south of Proudfit, the one that looks like it has decorative brick keys on the top floor, it was the Ogden Knitting Company in 1922. The original building is just the north side. Can you see how the brickwork on the top is different between the two halves? The south side is the later addition. And do you see Thorstensen written at the top of the north side? That family started the knitting company. Now, when I say knitting company, don't think chunky wool sweaters and scratchy old-fashioned scarves. This was the 1920s, a brave new world, the world of rayon and silk and rayon crepe and crepe de chine. Ads from the Ogden Knitting Company help us to build up a picture of what was inside. One lists lovely lady frocks, rayon underwear, men's and ladies' suits, bloomers, panties, slips, pajamas, bandeaus, and vests, athletic wear, men's shorts. It was quite a stock. One ad calls for models. Let me read it to you. Young ladies, we need 10 or more girls for posing in hosiery and lingerie pictures. Applications will be taken during the rest of this week. Good pay. Yes, the Ogden Knitting Company made a lot of lingerie. But how come they only made lingerie for women? Don't men want to sleep in the luxury of silk sometimes? Is it really only women who want to be sexy and elegant? These cultural assumptions about who likes what run deep. I can see why eventually the Ogden Knitting Company had to expand, because they made just about everything. In addition to men's and ladies' suits, lingerie, hosiery, underwear, children's clothes, they also made LDS-approved regulation garments. So whatever you needed, they had it. Next, do you see that orange rust-colored building across the street? That was owned by the Knights of Pythias, a fraternal order that was actually the first to receive its charter by an act of Congress in 1864. They're a non-sectarian fraternity, still around today, that promotes cooperation and friendship between people of goodwill. They promote service to mankind and believe that friendship is essential to a happy life. Benevolence, kindness, and generosity are central to their lives. And that sounds to me a lot like Jane Richards' "That love and goodwill and peace and joy be extended to all." And I wonder, did men and women really have to achieve these ends separately? Jane Richards led her all-female National Relief Society, and the Knights of Pythias were all male. What could they have done? What might they have achieved if they had joined together? In the parking lot south of the Pythians building, there used to be a large building with a steep roof and a wraparound porch. It was the Smithsonian Business and Shorthand School, founded in 1891 by the Smith family. The family served as faculty members, and in one photo, there are more female faculty than male. The students were mostly female as well. Here, they learned shorthand, as well as filing systems, penmanship, typewriters, all the stuff that's a dying art these days. And I think it's important to acknowledge here that the women were training to be secretaries at the reception desk, while the men were training to be the big man in the office. And Jane Richards saw that, even in the 1890s. Why aren't women in the big office? Because they're not allowed to learn the skills to be in the big office. The unfairness of it wasn't lost on women back then. But wow, those gendered notions were so deeply entrenched, it's taken us a good 100 years to get over them. Still, back then, the Smithsonian Business School was a pretty big step for a young woman, a way to earn her own income and play an important role out in the world. Next on that side of the street, you see a grand Greek Revival stone building. It was the post office for most of its history. It was built in a Renaissance Greek style. You can see the bottom floor is extra massive and fortress-looking, and then as you get higher and higher, it becomes more and more decorative until you get to the top with its dentated pediment and its Corinthian pilasters. This is grand stuff. Ogden was really declaring itself here. And this kind of architecture is basically saying, we're very fancy and important, but don't mess with us. This is a fortress. On your left, after the looming parking tower, you'll see something completely different come into view. It's one of the oldest churches in Ogden, the Episcopal Church of the Good Shepherd, 1870. And I think it's sitting here pretty gracefully and patiently, enduring its new neighbor, the parking tower. And it will, I think, be here long after the tower comes down. It's built in what's called Carpenter Gothic style, which emerged in America when steam-powered scroll saws could mass-produce swirly decorative wooden moldings. Another way to describe Carpenter Gothic is gingerbread house. This church was made possible when a Mr. Hammersley of New York paid for its construction as a way to memorialize his daughter, Catherine Livingston, who died in childbirth while traveling through Ogden. She still has a marble memorial plaque inside. Pause here in front of the church at the corner, looking out into the intersection. There is another powerhouse of a woman in Ogden history who lived just over there on the diagonal in what's now the parking lot of the Courtyard Marriott Hotel. Now, I realize I'm showing you a lot of empty lots on this tour, but really that's part of the story. It's a long story, so if you want, see that bench over to your left? Go ahead and have a seat while I tell it to you. And really, this is for your own safety, because the story is so amazing, you might pass out. There, in 1890, was the Grand House of Belle London, Utah's most notorious and powerful madam. She ran not just a brothel, but pretty much the whole of Electric Alley, the red light district that lay just beyond the Marriott Hotel. She was deemed to be the most powerful person in Ogden, and she ran her operation like a well-oiled machine. She believed in discipline and order. No drunks, no police calls, no violence on her watch, she said. It may seem counterintuitive nowadays, but she considered herself the greatest women's advocate of them all because she paid for them to go to school if they wanted. She paid for all their medical bills. She provided security, independence, and an income to women that the rest of society left behind. Prostitution has always been a controversial business, so Belle London is one of those untamed women I would love to meet. What was she really like? Our sources on her are annoyingly scarce. But we do have a photograph of her. And if you're picturing a colorful Wild West brothel madam with red silk and big hair, then you'd never have been able to identify Belle London. She looked more like a stuffy schoolmarm, buttoned up, tidy, little bow tie, pearl earrings. Her conservative, non-threatening appearance served her well as she ruled Ogden's underworld. This lady, she's harmless. And it was always the women who were punished in these kinds of situations, not the men who were the patrons. There's that moral double standard again. Belle London said that men and women should be held to the same laws, rules, and expectations. Why was purity and goodness required of women only? For someone we know was immensely powerful in Ogden, it is frustrating that we don't know more about her. And Jane Richards, too. And Sarah Anderson. And Marianna Coulter. And Grandma Ruby. Why don't we know their stories? Why are their buildings all gone? It's a funny thing, history. Some stories persist through collective memory, but usually all we historians have are obituaries, tombstones, archived newspaper articles here and there. Jane Richards' obituary was an extensive two-page spread in the Ogden Standard in 1912, reporting the speeches given at her funeral. In column after column, we can read what was said by the men who spoke. And here's the thing. All spoke at length, not about her, her husband and son, saying it was her great honor to be associated with such men. When they did speak of Jane, they never even alluded to her lifetime's work for women's equality, and instead idealized her as a ministering angel who served the sick and needy, While her charitable deeds were indeed countless, she had said that she hoped they would not call her a ministering angel after death. Instead, she wished to be remembered as consistent. Women like Jane Richards so often get remembered as sweet, kindly angels of service, while their bolder, edgier power moves are quietly left out of the story. And the boldest and edgiest of all, Belle London, the most powerful person in Ogden, well, nobody dared to write about her. She didn't fit into society's accepted historical narratives, and framing her as a kindly ministering angel wasn't going to work. People wanted to sweep unsavory things like Electric Alley under the rug, or under the parking lot. I want to take you east on 24th Street now, to a building that miraculously was not torn down. Turn toward the mountains and follow the sidewalk east. Do you hear that? It's the Berthana, one of the largest, swankiest ballrooms in Utah. It's across the street, on the south side. Two-story brick, red on the bottom, beige on the top. Can you see it? You can see its arts and crafts decorative brick kind of cascading down from the top. It used to have a giant sign out front that said, "Dancing," and every weekend it was packed. The ballroom was built in 1915 by Bertha Eccles and Anna Dee, hence Berthana. They wanted a classy ballroom for Ogden's younger generations to socialize. And as Bertha Eccles and Anna Dee were members of the wealthiest families in Ogden, they spared no expense. At its grand opening, May 1915, the newspapers couldn't gush enough.
"Opening of the Berthana is a brilliant social success. Most beautiful ballroom in the West is dedicated in a most pleasing manner. Governor Spry takes part in the festivities and congratulates those who made the social hall possible." "I desire to congratulate Ogden on the magnificence of this building, this ballroom. It is indeed glorious. Nowhere in the United States have I seen so beautiful a place built for such purposes. It stands as one of the marks of the Ogden spirit, if we may call it that, which means cooperation in the upbuilding of the city. I also desire to congratulate the Eccles family and Mrs. D and her family on this wonderful accomplishment."
For decades, this ballroom was the site of loud big bands, pounding feet, love and heartbreak, weddings, and my favorite, women's suffrage meetings. Inside, the paneling, paint, plaster, and chandeliers were spectacular. Once the heyday of ballrooms was passed, and really I wish we would bring it back, the Berthana was converted into a roller skating rink that some Ogden locals still vividly remember. Once the heyday of roller skating was passed, and yeah, let's bring that back too, it sat vacant for years before much of the building was revitalized so it could take its new form as a restaurant today. And see that tall brick building to the east of the Berthana? That's the Kiesel Building, 1913. More on that in a minute. But look at that tiny little building squeezed between the Kiesel Building and the Berthana. I admire the gumption of that quaint little thing. It was built in 1890, so it was here before its neighbors, and it just stood there boldly while the giants went up around it. It was a cigar shop and then a pharmacy for decades. And it still has some of its original features, like its beautiful arched windows. And if you look closely, you can see little faces carved into the top of the red stone pillars on the left and right. Can you see them? And the entryway still has its original hexagonal tile. Victorians liked to tile porches because you could mop tile. It really helped combat the dirty streets. Now walk further east so you can see the corner of the Kiesel Building, the tall one, and see how long it is. By 1913, it was stylish to have square windows instead of those old-fashioned Victorian arches. The top floor is really elegant with its decorative brick and balcony. Until 1961, this building was home to the Ogden Standard newspaper, which later became the Standard Examiner. That paper has been a key source of so much of our information from Ogden's past. But of course, 80, 90, 100 years ago, the information those guys deemed worthy of reporting was selective at best. So many times we don't even know a woman's name because she's reported as Mrs. Peter Copeland or Mrs. J.W. Henderson. Every person is a product of their time and place, and calling a woman Mrs. Peter Copeland probably felt respectful back in the day. They didn't see the erasure of identity that we see today. So, even though we have to dig a bit deeper to overcome the blind spots of the past, and even though many of the buildings are gone, it's not too late. We can still find the women who lived, worked, struggled, and dreamed here in Ogden, and we can tell their stories in a new way. Carry on eastward, back towards St. Joseph's where we started, unless you'd prefer to stay here downtown when our tour is over. There are so many stories in history. Every person is a story. Every interaction, another story still. I wish I could tell you even more about the women we've been uncovering over the past year. There's Dora Kaufman, who sold books down the block for a decade and ignited people's passion for reading. Alice Hirai, who came here from the Topaz Japanese internment camp and spent her life advocating for disadvantaged people because she said she knew all too well what it was like. Rachel Ann Brown nursed the sick every day all over Ogden during the flu epidemic of 1917, staying up every night sterilizing sheets. After that, she was a midwife delivering babies across the city. Each birth, she would stay for a week to do house chores and give the new moms a rest. Lilybelle Frey Falk, a member of the Japanese American Citizens, planted 66,000 trees in Snow Basin to honor war veterans, and she was known as the Flag Lady for her lifetime's advocacy of flags in public places. And there was Emma Emmertson, who graduated Ogden School for the Blind and Deaf in 1907. She became the second deaf student ever to be admitted to the University of Utah. And when she graduated there, she and a classmate decided to walk from Ogden to Washington, D.C., spreading literature on how to educate the deaf along the way. They persisted through hell and high water, but the newspapers made sure to note that they didn't make it all the way, because such a feat was far too dangerous for girls. Personally, I admire them for daring to even start such a journey. For the whole history of Ogden, visionary, brave, smart, hopeful women have been walking these very streets. Women have been pushing boundaries, large and small, bravely living in defiance of society's pigeonholes. And I think we're ready to hear these stories now, 100 years after the 19th Amendment, and not just to hear them, but to tell them too. When you go looking for women doing bold and brave things in history, you find them. Try it out. You can start with a simple Google search. Newspapers.com is a treasure trove. Weber State Special Collections welcomes inquiries on all things Weber County. You can search county records, national censuses, genealogy records too. And you know that newspaper I mentioned at the start, the one created by the women of Utah? It's called the Women's Exponent, and it's all digitized now and searchable. That's where Utah's women left their stories for us to find. dig into the women in your own neighborhood or club or hobby, family history. I think you'll find their stories are there, waiting patiently to be celebrated. Thank you for taking this audio tour. This tour was made possible by the Weber County Heritage Foundation, Weber State University Special Collections, and What's Her Name podcast. If you want to get involved with our future projects, preserving and celebrating Weber County history, find us on Instagram and Facebook, or head to our website, WeberCountyHeritageFoundation.com. There you can also find the first steps to starting your own historical research. You might also want to check out our other walking tours, Notorious 25th Street and An Insider's Guide to Union Station. You can find them where you found this one. This tour was written by Katie Nelson, with research by Shelby Durant and Kate Stewart. It was edited by Daniel Foster Smith, who also provided original music and sound design. Additional music was recorded by the Weber State University Choirs and Orchestra at St. Joseph's Church. It also featured music by Andy Reiner and the New Hot Five. Antique recordings can be found at the Library of Congress.